Seems like I get up here so frequently that I'm not really sure what to do with some of these messages. But I want us to understand that we're in a battle, and the battle is not yet won. God who cares still looks at the harvest, and the God who loves still calls, but there's so much work to be done. I want to give us the challenge that maybe some of his people are absent without official leave. I think we've gotten so involved in the American way of life, we think it's an entitlement form of Christianity. But if you recall, we stopped last time in Judges chapter 2, verses 15 and 16. And in that passage, the first 16 verses indicates how far people went astray. They served the Lord all the days of Joshua and the elders. And then they served the Baals. And then verse 15, wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for calamity, as God had predicted, and they were greatly distressed. Verse 16, boy, that jumps out to me. Nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges who delivered them. Now, man's plight is never so bad that the grace of God can't reach them. And I want us to understand, well, I wasn't going to go to this, but where we are, it starts out at the beginning of the book with a lot of the compromises that the people made as they captured the land. In the midst of all those compromises, there were some bright spots, Caleb and Othniel, but they were willing to settle just for what cost them the least amount of effort and risk. And then we are at this place now where we're about ready to start at the Seven Cycles Rebellion. But all the way through the book, the theme is, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And from the book of Judges, we picked out the theme, anarchy from apathy. Now, when people don't care, it's going to always lead to anarchy, or it's going to lead to autocracy. After people couldn't live with this way of life for a while, Samuel, who overlapped Samson's reign, is approached by the people and said, we need a king. He's going to solve our problems. And yet the king didn't solve the problem. We have just finished 8 years in an experiment with communism. I taught enough government to know it when I see it. Doesn't matter what name it goes by, fascism, communism, any kind of statism, Nazism was that. That was corrupted by what Hitler's phobia was about the Jews, but still the form of government is what we were being drawn to, especially in attempts to get us to be a globalist economy. But I'm more concerned about the culture. And as we come to this next section here, this clicker is giving me a problem, we will come to a number of leaders that God calls to deliver his people when they go into bondage. And to speed things up, the message we just had was, what is God looking for in a leader? And we saw that he is looking for people who will be faithful as his spokesman. People aren't going to find the truth anyplace else except from Christians. It doesn't matter how we give them the truth. If we abnegate our responsibility and people come to us and say, what do you think about? And we say, well, you know, I don't want to get involved, or we don't want to be accused of hate speech and all that. Sometimes we bow out of giving them an unpleasant message. But if I read the scriptures correctly and that person is asking me, what is God's opinion about same-sex marriage, homosexuality? What is his opinion about abortion? And all of those issues, as a Christian, I need to understand that my giving him God's verdict may make the difference in his spiritual well-being for eternity. So for me to imply to him that it doesn't really matter, or live and let live, it doesn't matter. If I cop out as a believer, he's not going to just stumble across a Gideon Bible, possibly. He's not just going to find a tract lying on the street that somebody threw away. God has used that, but in general, the church is a pillar and ground of the truth. And it's you and me as the church that speaks on behalf of God. We are his spokesman. We have an obligation to let him know what the truth is that he will endorse. We're to be a spokesman. We're to be intercessors for the culture. We're to be his servant who obey him. Now, what I want to focus on today in the time we have left is, what are we looking for as his servants? He has expectations, but we have expectations. And here's where the problem is. Because when you look at what we're looking for, keep in mind now, we just put this up here. God calls us as a soldier. He's drafted us into his service. And we're to obey the commander-in-chief. He has called us as an athlete to run according to the rules in the rule book. He has called us as a farmer who works hard for the future harvest. And this is where I want to emphasize today. Now, if you look at this, I think it's a rather serene scene. Our granddaughter, Mary Barrows, does artwork. I don't know how many children's books she's illustrated for. Probably a couple dozen by now. I don't know where she gets her artistic ability. It didn't come from me. But anyway, she sent this actually in an email. She keeps us updated on what she's doing. And you can see her watermark there. And I told her I was going to use it anyway, watermark or no watermark. Well, that's okay. But a quiet evening. Well, I looked at that and thought, man, doesn't it look comfortable? Now, we guys need a recliner. This would never work for me. But the thing that will top it off completely is a piece of apple pie with ice cream. Our daughter and son-in-law took me and Charlotte out to Silver Diner, of all people, for a birthday. Well, they didn't know I like truck stops and good food, so we went to Silver Diner, and boy, they had one of these pieces of pie. I hadn't seen one of those for years. I don't know how many years it's been since I had a piece of apple pie, homemade apple pie with ice cream. Peach crumb pie is a tad better, but I had to settle for what I got. But boy, wouldn't that make that really comfy? We call that a comfort zone, especially during cold weather. I mean, just whip up a big bowl of potato soup and just sit there and relax on the inside while it might be snowing outside. It almost doesn't get any better than that, does it? It doesn't. What is it that makes our life comfortable? Well, you look at all these things. We Americans have gotten spoiled with safety. When you look at what's happening to the rest of the world, and then with ISIS just wiping out whole villages of Christians, just ruthlessness in Africa. It's horrible what people are putting up with in the rest of the world. We have been miraculously spared for much of that. What about security? Oh yeah, we have to have our security, not only financially, but otherwise. And people who enforce the law of the land. I'm glad for our police force. Man, I wouldn't want one of my sons come to me, or daughters, and say, Dad, it's time to be a policeman. I mean, they're targets nowadays. Doing a valuable job of keeping us safe. Satisfaction, personal peace and affluence is what Francis Schaeffer called it. Just a kind of a life of ease, peace and serenity. Just success. You know, we haven't gotten our pink slip yet from our employer, even though times are tough. The approval of others, boy, that is something we really, really need. Sometimes you think that it's a susceptibility of our teens. I think adults are just as susceptible to peer pressure. We want people to think well of us. And boy, when the news media out there says, if you say this, you say that, that's not politically correct, you're a homophobe, or it's hate speech, boy, that makes you want to cower away from it. You just don't want to get involved. But the bigger question is, what does God want us to do? And here's where the battle is taking place now, and that is our convictions. That's where we're being attacked. That's where Christians find it much easier to back off. And churches are compromising in this area. And then other believers, we just kind of keep a low profile. And I'm hoping things will change now, that at least we have attorney generals who will keep some of this injustice and nonsense as we lose our freedoms one by one to a pagan culture. I look at the people that God called. I look at Moses. God said, hey, I've got a chore for you. Well, he didn't use the word chore. I've got a really great privilege for you. And Moses probably would have said, well, I'm not so sure about that. Who am I that I should go back to Egypt. There's a wanted poster for him. Big reward for him for treason. Who am I? And the Lord said, you don't have to worry about that. You're not going in your authority, you're going in mine. And then Moses said, well, now, who are you? Well, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I am the eternally existent one. You will go in my authority because I've heard there's a need of my people who are crying out for my help. And now's the time. Moses, you're it. Moses, you're it. Then Moses goes to the next lily pad of excuses. Well, Lord, I can't speak very well. Now, how do we know that's an excuse? Sight and sound, I love sight and sound, but they got it all wrong. They make Moses a stutterer. He was not. Acts chapter 7 makes it clear that Moses was a man who was mighty in word and deed. He could speak quite well. I think what Moses is saying here, Lord, I've been away from Egypt for 40 years. I'm rusty on the language. It doesn't matter. It was a fake reason because he didn't want his comfort zone invaded. He was on the backside of the desert watching sheep with a wife and at least one son by that point. And God says, in order for you to be of service to me, I'm going to really have to shake up your comfort zone. I'm just going to have to rattle you loose from it. So Moses said, I don't have the ability. And the Lord said, who do you think made your mouth? I will give you the ability. So the third issue with Moses was availability. Lord, find somebody else. Well, it's too late for that. Aaron, your brother's already on the way. You two are going to go back to Egypt. Look at Gideon. People make fun of him saying he's a coward. He was not a coward. He was just a smart man. He was winnowing grain on the leeward side of the hill because there were many knights who would pass by every now and then. But he used every excuse he could to get out of the book, excuse in the book, to get out what God wanted him to do, asking, well, give me some dew, then give me some dry grass. You know, Lord, I'm just not sure I want to go. Look at Barak. We'll come across him later. I think the man was probably brave. God called him for service. But Barak said, Lord, I'm not going to go up and fight the enemy unless Deborah goes with me, who was a judge of Israel at the time. We'll come back to that a little bit later. If his name indeed was a name called Lapidoth, which was the name of Deborah's husband, then it may be that Barak looked upon Deborah as his wife and wanted her along with him, but mainly because of her leadership, and he wanted to make sure God was on his side. So he said, Deborah, I want her to go up with me. Look at Amos. I wasn't a prophet. I wasn't the son of a prophet. I was just out manning my own business. I was out tending the sheep as a herdsman on the quiet hills of Tekoa. And God called me, and the implication is in the book of Ezra, or Amos, I really didn't want to go. I knew the dangers because these kings are putting people to death who don't say what they want. So it wasn't an easy call. I look at Saul, not of the New Testament, but when they come to make him king, for good or ill, he's hiding amongst the baggage and the donkeys. And they have to drag him out to assume the robe that God had put upon his shoulders. You look at Jonah. Was it prejudice? Was it patriotism? We don't have time to go into that. But he sure didn't want to go to the Ninevites. He heard they skinned people alive and impaled them on poles. And if he goes into them and says, your great nation, your city-state here, is going to be destroyed in 40 days. And they would say to him, guess what? You first. It wasn't a safe thing. We don't know what his motive was. I mean, you look at Peter. God knew his prejudice. So God starts early by letting a sheep down with, or sheep, that is, with unclean animals. Rise, Peter, kill and eat. Not so, Lord. Heaven let an unkosher item pass my lips all the time. I'm a good practicing Jew. Three times that happened. And while he wondered about this, a messenger comes while he's at the house of Joppa, the tanner, saying, Cornelius, a Roman, wants you to come. And the Lord had to say to him, go, nothing doubting, go ahead, because I'm in this. He had to work with his prejudice first so that Peter would know that this is a call of God to go to Gentiles, because the minute Peter walks into Cornelius' house, he said, now you know that it's not lawful for us to go into the house of a Gentile. He already knew. He had his prejudices. He really probably didn't want to go. As a matter of fact, in Acts 11:2, they of the circumcision contended with him. And the only way he could defend himself, when I saw the Spirit of God following them, the Cornelius and his family, who was I that I should withstand God? And they held their peace, saying, well, then God apparently has granted salvation to the Gentiles. You know, he didn't want to go. Barnabas, he was called to go after Paul was blinded. Barnabas is responsible. Now, Lord, you may not have read the morning papers, but this fellow has been killing Christians right and left. You know, are you sure that this is what I should be involved in? And the Lord simply had already given him the walking papers. You go, because he is a chosen vessel to me, and you will tell him what great things he must suffer for my sake. Jeremiah, Betsy quoted that one. When he received the call of God, he said, oh Lord, I'm just a child. I'm just a young man. And God said, don't worry about whether you're a youth or not, because before I formed you in the womb, I knew you and I ordained you to be a prophet. Don't tell me that God doesn't have a person's purpose and life outlined in advance. You know, he's got some great things in store for us, and he just wants us to be involved. So, you know, most of the really great leaders in the Bible were the ones who were elected leaders. Sometimes you get the idea that you have to be this overly aggressive, ambitious kind of person. No, no, no. A leader has to be a servant who is a servant first of God and then a servant for everybody else. And that's going to cost a lot. It's going to cost you. When God calls you, there will be danger and risk. Could be your life. Could be financially. You look at Paul and what he suffered there in 2 Corinthians. Boy, I tell you. And I look at our missionaries around the world, and we support missionaries all over. I think we give, 20% of our budget to missions now. Pregnancy Center is one of them. But if you choose something that is dear to your heart and focus on it, and if the pregnancy center is dear to you for whatever reason, just go ahead and put out some of that extra money into an offering and designate it for the pregnancy center, because you can be involved in the salvaging of human lives that are just going to be snuffed out by doctors who have no scruples. Sometimes he calls us to deprivation and sacrifice. Could go into a lot of detail on that one. Sometimes he calls us to a place of failure in quotation marks and insignificance. A good practicing Christian most of the time is going to be considered to be a failure by the world. Some of them are noteworthy, like R.J. Letourneau of the tractor manufacturing business. He found he could live on 10% of his income, and he gave 90% to the Lord. Well, I look at people like that and think, that's great. I look at missionaries who've given their lives. Well, they've made the ultimate sacrifice. Jim Elliot, everybody here probably can quote that. A man is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain that which he can never lose. And when he and the other missionaries were martyred at the Auckland Indians, you would have said, well, that's the end of the story, isn't it? No, no, no. Not if you follow his wife and Rachel Saint, Nate Saint's sister. They went back, and the Auckland Indian tribes were reached by the gospel, and they may have never been reached apart from the martyrdom of these five people in, 1955 or thereabouts. Ridicule and rejection. Well, we don't like that. Well, we want this to be protected at all cost. And yet we're fully aware that when we are of service to God, it's going to cost us something that we really don't want to give up. Now, Moses was willing to give it up because he esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than all the treasures of Egypt. In other words, Hebrews chapter 11, who says, some did not accept deliverance because they had respect to a greater resurrection. What you do is you look at it and say, the cost that I'm paying, the price that I'm paying, is worth it because of the reward I'll reap later. Don't expect God to settle all of his accounts in October. Sometimes God says, have to hang in there for a little bit longer, and then I'll show you what I have. The modern battleground that you and I are in is the assault of biblical truth and Christian values. There's no doubt of it. And it's almost at a place we've never seen, at least in my half century and more of living. Paul says our gospel is veiled. It's veiled to those who are perishing. The God of this age has blinded their minds, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ should shine on them. God has commanded light to shine out of darkness, and he has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God. And then if you go to 2 Corinthians 10, it indicates the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. They're not fleshly. They're not physical. But they're mighty in God for pulling down strongholds. What are the strongholds? Arguments, high things that exalt themselves against the knowledge of God, every thought that is running maverick to the purposes of God. We need to understand there's a battlefield going on in everybody's mind. It's a battlefield for allegiance. Whose purposes will you and I follow? We need to understand whether it's an unsaved person or even whether it's a believer. Satan can influence us, and the more we make choices that are in harmony with what he wants, the more they get a grip on us until we're in bondage and captivity to something many times we said, that would never get a grip on me. And yet it's a stronghold. The target that Satan uses is always the mind. If he gets our allegiance, he will automatically have what we own, what we work at, what we say. But especially the unbelieving mind is like this. And he uses deception or lies to do that. What's his goal? It's to keep people in bondage, keep them blind, keep them deceived. And you and I come into contact with friends and relatives and coworkers and family, well, relatives, but neighbors. And after a while, you would figure, how could that fella reach adulthood, be so dumb? And by the way, I'm not being unkind, because I don't judge people like that. But you know, sometimes the irrationality that people live by, you know, you wonder, how could a person think that? It doesn't make sense politically, scientifically, and otherwise. But again, Satan has blinded their minds. This is from one of the crazy games, but all of us are acquainted with the fact that there's a big army around about here, and it's laying siege to the castle. We'll have good or worse success, depending on how well guarded that is. But the purpose is to take the stronghold here that people are holed up in. I think of Masada. And when you look from this direction at Masada, and you can see the Dead Sea back there, the last holdout of the Jews from the 70 AD, well, actually, they actually took Masada in 67, and then finally Silvius got around to attacking Masada and didn't take it until 3 years after Jerusalem fell in 73 AD. But that was just about impregnable, except the Romans. But the interesting thing about it, when Herod built a castle up here, there, it was very limited access to get to that place. In other words, when the Jewish people wanted to establish a final base, which was hard to overcome, they retreated up to the top of this. And then the governor of Judea, who succeeded Pilate by a couple of different ones, laid siege to this, played by Peter Strauss in a tremendous movie on the whole thing, because he was just had mixed emotions about whether or not to attack this place. But the Jewish people would stand up here while the Romans were bringing up siege towers up that ramp, and they would throw rocks down, and it was something that they figured we'd never be able to overcome this place. Sylvius was bright. So he said, there's one way to solve that. So he went out and got a bunch of Jewish prisoners and had them bring up the sieges. And when the Jews on top of the plateau heard that their fellow countrymen were being forced to bring up the armaments, they said, we would rather die than kill a fellow countryman. So they did not protect themselves, but they wanted the last victory. So if you recall the story, 960 of them committed suicide. Two women, three children survived. But just because it was a hard, hard place to capture, and I'm not going to go into tire with this, our time's already up for today, but I want us to understand that in a person's mind, first of all, the unbeliever's mind, it's blinded by spiritual deception. So when you and I are given the message to them, let's face it, they're not going to really understand it, are they? Unless they're open and sensitive somewhat to being taught by God's Spirit. I tell you, it could be a crisis. Betsy works with people like that all the time. You may work with friends and neighbors. Sometimes a crisis has driven them to the place where they're at the end of their own resources and they're willing to say, is there something that somebody can say that will help me? And then you and Christians, I as Christians, are there to say, my God can help you. He's the one who has the answer to your problems. And as they respond to the truth, God gives them more truth and more truth. It isn't always the case that you can always lead them to the Lord right on the spot. But you can plant the seed, and I can plant the seed. And then somebody else may see the harvest. But you look at this and say, well, you know, Andy, you think God's ever going to call me to part the Red Sea again? Is he going to call me to do this, to do that? Is he going to call me like one of these great leaders? Hey, get that out of our minds right away, because God has already called us. God already has a great purpose for every single one of us. And it may not seem big as far as the world is concerned. It may not seem important as far as even the church is concerned, because, you know, we're susceptible to looking for the biggies, the big projects and the big ministries and things like that. We want to be a part of that. It's a bandwagon approach. But when God says, Andy, when you're ushered in my presence, I'm not going to ask you about all the big accomplishments. I'm going to simply say, Andy, were you faithful in sharing your convictions with your kids? Were you faithful in just taking advantage of the little opportunities here and there to speak a word on my behalf when it was appropriate? And it's going to mean that I'm going to have to right now decide that he has laid a claim that I'm his completely, and my comfort zone is going to get in the way. Now, I don't know what it is about you. I probably know what it is about me, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. But there's always something in our life that provides an excuse for not getting involved in the privilege that God has called us to. And later, when we get back to this, not today, our next message, we will find that there are these strongholds in a person's mind. There are different ones in a Christian's mind, some same ones, but some different ones. So as you and I have the opportunity to speak to that individual, we should understand sometimes prejudice is, and hate is blinding them so much that they can't even see clearly. Sometimes bad life experiences have just twisted their thinking about relationships. Sometimes they're involved in lustful relationships. It's got a grip on them. Sometimes just fear. I mean, all of the, it doesn't matter what it is. It simply means that as long as that stronghold is there, that person is going to be rather hard to reach. But here's the assurance that we're not going it alone. When I speak to that individual, I'm not depending upon my powers to persuade. I'm not depending upon the latest thing to come down the pike, the latest gimmick. I'm not depending on the church putting on a circus and inviting people in from the community. But where I am, where I'm being faithful, it's God's Spirit who brings about conviction and enlightenment. And I'm simply there to say to this individual, you know, I'm not going to give you my opinion, but from what you tell me, it seems to me that you have a real problem that you're grappling with. You know, let me share something with you that I think will help you, because it's God's way of dealing with your problem. First of all, your spiritual problem. Boy, when he died on the cross, he took care of that one. Your emotional problem. Well, we're probably going to have to work on that, but you need to understand there's somebody who loves you and accepts you for you who you are, and he wants to bring meaning and purpose in your life. And if you and I have the privilege of sharing this truth with them, hopefully they will come to know him and have eternal life, and you and I can deal with other issues that are strongholds in their own mind. Didn't even get halfway through, but when we come back to this, I want to show how this works out in the Christian's life, but I'm more concerned right now with the idea that we're aware of what the battlefield is. It is no longer going up against Philistines and Perizzites and Amorites and all the others in a physical battle. We're on a battlefield now for the minds and the hearts of people. So we need different weapons, and we need different marching orders from headquarters, and we certainly need the backup of God's Spirit who is leading us to say the right thing at the right time. Shall we stand and close in prayer? Our Father, we thank you for your great grace unto us. Oh, we're so thankful that you called us out of darkness into your marvelous light. We're so appreciative of what your grace paid for our redemption. And yet your grace is more than just redemption, so we're thanking you that your Spirit is given to us so that we can live by his leadership and power and direction, and that we can have the assurance that we belong to you. And might your heart be our heart, and might we be burdened for others that we know, others with whom we come in contact. And might our attitude be, Lord, you called me. You've given me your authority. You've given me your ability. And now I will give to you my availability. What great things you will accomplish through a life that is yielded to your purposes. Thank you for the privilege. In Christ's name, amen.